Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and we are standing by as Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton is about to deliver an economic speech in Michigan at a company called Futuramic. They are a tool and engineering company in Warren, and that's a suburb of Detroit. She's expected, among other things, to give more detail on the jobs plan that she announced in Raleigh, North Carolina, back in June.
Earlier this week, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump also spoke about his economic policies in front of the Detroit Economic Club. We brought you that speech. We will bring you Clinton's speech live from Michigan when she begins in just a few minutes. But as we wait, we are joined by Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, NPR business reporter Jim Zaroli, NPR political correspondent Don Gagne is with us from Michigan. And also joining us is Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons and economist Douglas Holtz Aiken, former chief economist of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. And he's now president at the American Action Forum. Don Gagne, I want to start with you in Michigan. Set the scene for us.
We are in Warren, Michigan. This is a Detroit suburb. It sits right on the border of 8 Mile Road with Detroit. It is still a mostly white, very, very heavily working class community. And Hillary Clinton has come to this manufacturing company with a very futuristic name, Futuramic. And this is where she's going to give her rebuttal to what Donald Trump said earlier this week downtown at the Detroit Economic Club. Again, she has been making a hard pitch to working class voters, trying to convince them that what Donald Trump is trying to sell them is just not real, as good as it may sound to them. And that's going to be a part of the speech here today as well.
And Ron Elving, why Michigan? This is a state that has not voted Republican since 1988, and President George H.W. Bush and Clinton is well ahead in the polls, up by an average of about 6 or 7 points right now.
Nonetheless, Michigan presents a kind of perfect battleground for the ideas, if you will, that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are espousing. Donald Trump wanted to come to Detroit, in particular, the Detroit Economic Club, and say this city and all it has suffered, all the loss of population, all the loss of jobs, the decline of the auto industry over a long period of time, that's due to Hillary Clinton's agenda. It's due to the kind of trade deals that her husband, Bill Clinton, put into effect in the 1990s, and it is due to her reliance upon government programs. Now, one could argue, and Mr. Gagne has covered in great detail over the decades, what has happened to southeastern Michigan in the world trade wars. Donald Trump had a fairly straightforward and simple formulation for what had gone wrong.
Well, and I want to bring in Douglas Holtz Aiken to ask you about that. Again, former chief economist of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. You know, he, as Ron was saying, he said it was all the Clintons' fault and I will bring those jobs back. Other analysts are saying those jobs, many of them, are not coming back. So what does she have to do to not, you know, sort of dash the hopes of the people that she's speaking with in this region, give them some hope, but she can't just, you know, say what he said?
Well, I think the key for her will be to, rebut the things that are simply not true about what Mr. Trump's claiming. You can't draw a straight line between trade agreements and the difficulties of the auto and manufacturing sector. Instead, I think you need to say there is a future for manufacturing. Manufacturing employment has been growing, but we need to have policies that have that growth. Help people in the middle class. I have a set of those policies. We'll get the growth that he's promising, but we'll get the help to the middle class that he's not.
Yeah. Okay. And Jamal Simmons, again, a Democratic strategist, bring you in. As you know, this candidate is under a cloud, both candidates under clouds this week. Donald Trump, because of comments that he made about President Obama starting ISIS and about maybe gun enthusiasts should perhaps go after Hillary Clinton. His comments were interpreted that way. She, because of the emails that have come out showing a cozy relation between her family foundation and the State Department when she was secretary, does she bring up any of these things? Does she try to punch around them? What happens?
I doubt you will hear Hillary Clinton bring up anything that has to do with the emails, just because it's not something that her voters really care about. It's something that you hear about, particularly on the right. Fox News is full of invective about this. And there are probably some people who are soft Trump voters who maybe are thinking about it. But the people who are voting for her have already factored in that they either have made peace with whatever happened with the emails, or the Donald Trump is so odorous that they just can't possibly vote for him. So they'll go along with it regardless of how they feel. But I want to touch on real quickly on the fact that Hillary Clinton is in Macomb County today talking about this. And Don Gagne will remember this. Back in 1992, when Bill Clinton was running for president, he spoke in Macomb County. Mm. And one of the big points that he made when he was there was, let's not let racial divisions get in the way of our economic progress. He gave the same speech in Macomb County that he gave at Pleasant Grove Baptist Church in Detroit immediately after. And it was heralded as a positive thing. Stronger together is Hillary's point. If she refers to that or makes a similar pitch today, I think that would be very important in a place like southeastern Michigan, which has huge racial strife.
Yeah. I want to bring in NPR business reporter Jim Zaroli, who was also with us as we watched what Donald Trump had to say the other day about a moratorium on regulations and cutting taxes and renegotiating NAFTA. What about the substance of what we're likely to hear from Hillary Clinton today, Jim? What are you looking for?
I don't think we're going to get a lot of new ideas from her. I mean, she has policy positions that she's talked about a lot, like a 100-day infrastructure spending plan and making college tuition free for middle-class families in state. I think she's going to use this speech more to differentiate her policies from Trump's as much as possible, really by trying to attack his credentials as a populist. In other words, he talks a lot about the impact of the weak economy on the middle class, but I think she's going to try to make the argument that his policies, what he's actually talks about, really amount to the same old Republican playbook, you know, cutting taxes on the rich, trickle-down economics. The plan he announced Monday, I think she'll say, was you know, basically big tax cuts for corporations and wealthy people, as well as deregulation.
Yeah. Don Gagne, you're there at Futuramic Tool and Engineering in Warren outside Detroit. We remember when Donald Trump spoke earlier in the week, there were over a dozen protesters who had to be taken out. Who as you glance around, what are you seeing there?
It's a relatively small audience because, again, we're on a factory floor, a small, you know, factory floor in this manufacturing facility. This is a supplier to the auto industry here. It looks like it is a diverse group. It looks like they tend to be, you know, a little bit older on average, but it does not have the feel of a rally. I can tell you that it feels like people are here to listen to a policy speech, and a lot of them, frankly, are here still kind of sorting things out.
Yeah. And Ron Elving, has Hillary Clinton had to deal with protesters in her speeches much this campaign season the way that Donald Trump has time after time?
Not in the same way. There was a woman who rushed from the rear portion of the stage in a sort of stage in the round situation earlier this week at one of her rallies, and that person was taken out. But it was a rare, really, instance of even a momentary disruption. Her rallies are really quite different from Donald Trump's, even when they're much more political in nature and much more of a pep rally than this event today. They, generally speaking, do not have a large group of people inside the hall who are protesting, although there have been people with placards and things about emails, things about Benghazi, who are present at the venue. They're usually outside and not as disruptive.
Douglas Holtzakin, again, an economist who served under President George W. Bush and is now president of the American Action Forum. What did you think of the Trump speech the other day?
Well, I think the strong point was that he emphasized better economic growth. I think there's a lot of evidence that, you know, putting the capacity of the U.S. economy at 2% over the long term is putting the American dream just too far over the horizon. So that's the strong point. The downside is, it's a fairly incoherent set of proposals, some of which will be actually harmful to growth, and he's going to have a hard time making the case to a broad set of Republicans that that's really what they want to campaign on.
Yeah, and Douglas, I remember when you were with the Congressional Budget Office, you were known as someone who didn't suffer people who were foolish about math lightly, you know, people who used magic numbers. Where might you be looking to see if Hillary Clinton is making a promise she can't keep?
Her fundamental problem is that she's going to inherit, if elected, from President Obama, $9 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years. And she's made proposals to widen those deficits. She's raised $1.3 in taxes, but she's got a lot more than that in spending proposals. So not only is she not solving the problem she inherits, she's making it worse. And that's something that she's really going to need to explain.
Yeah, that's economist Douglas Holtz-Aiken, former chief economist of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush, and as I just said, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. We also have with us Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons and a whole flock of people from NPR. We have Jim Zaroli, John Elving, and Don Gagne.
A school, I think we could call them.
All right, like in fish. And we appreciate you all. We're waiting for Hillary Clinton, the Democratic presidential candidate, who's going to be making her economic plan known in Warren, Michigan. And it's just a couple minutes away.
And Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist, so much of the primary campaign was about the issue of income inequality because of the race that Hillary Clinton faced against Senator Bernie Sanders. Do you think she's still trying to bring those more liberal Democrats who were supporting Sanders, that working class, into her campaign that they haven't been convinced yet?
You know, this is the fundamental, this issue of income inequality is the fundamental question of facing the American economy. The truth is we've had growth, we've had increased income coming into the economy, but it's the distribution that's the problem. People at the bottom aren't seeing the results of the benefits that we've had taking place over the last few years. So that is where she's going to go. Partially that's going to help her when she goes to talk to some of those Bernie Sanders voters who she needs to solidify and keep on her team. But it's also going to talk to some of the folks who maybe are just in the middle and feel like nobody's looking out for them. And when they realize that Donald Trump issued a pretty detailed plan about how he's going to cut the corporate tax rate to 15% for the wealthiest, but he hasn't issued a plan about how he's going to help people at the bottom increase their incomes. Well, and so I think she'll lay that out today.
Well, and of course, his people would say that he has, but Don Gagne, to
I'd
what,
like to see it.
to what Jamal was just talking about, what do you see when you're out there? I mean, these people both have been around. He's been around for decades as a reality star and a businessman. Mm-hmm. She's been in the public eye. What more do people need to hear?
That's a good question. And it feels like when you go to their rallies, the positions on the two of them have hardened, right? You talk to Donald Trump supporters, and they will countenance no fact check. They will accept nothing that conflicts with the view of the world that he has just presented to them. You do, on occasion, get someone who will wince a little bit and say, you know, I wish he would dial it back a little bit every now and then. I wish he hadn't said that. And then with Hillary Clinton supporters, there are increasingly people caught up in the history of the moment, and they talk about that. Increasingly, I find myself at events this week bumping into Bernie Sanders supporters who are now on board for Secretary mm-hmm. Clinton. Some of them, admittedly, reluctantly, but they seem to be the ones who have kind of just gotten on board, and they're trying to reconcile what she's saying with what they can support and what they can kind of justify in their own head in terms of their vote.
Mm-hmm. That's NPR's Don Gagne in Michigan. And if you're just joining us, we are waiting for Hillary Clinton to outline her economic plan in Michigan. We brought you Donald Trump's remarks a few days ago, and we're going to bring you Hillary Clinton's remarks as soon as she starts speaking, which should be any minute now. Jim Zaroli, NPR business correspondent. One of the things that we've heard from the Trump side, from the Republican side, is that Hillary Clinton wants to raise your taxes a lot. I think they've used a number that is even more than $1 trillion, which is something that's been said about President Obama as well. Have taxes gone up much under the Obama administration?
Well, it's sort of a perennial accusation that's made about Democratic candidates. I think Hillary Clinton does say that she would impose a surcharge on really wealthy people, billionaires and multimillionaires. So I don't think that's wrong. I think she would say that she has no plans to increase taxes on the middle class.
Yeah. We are, as we have been saying, awaiting, and usually Hillary Clinton is known to be right on the dime, but she was supposed to be up at about 4:15. It's now 20 past. We're not, complaining, but letting you know that that's what we are waiting for, as our people at a tool and engineering plant, Future Ramic in Warren, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. We've got a whole lineup with us, and I want to go back to Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Get to that question of what do people need to hear? You know, we've talked about what Bernie Sanders people need to hear, a little more about inequity. Her own people will back her no matter what. What can she say to get the Trump person who might be on the fence, especially after some of his comments this week?
You know, I was talking to a pollster friend of mine today who was telling me that the reality is the sensibility about Donald Trump is pretty baked in. People think he's erratic. People think that some of his ideas are things they wouldn't necessarily agree with. But what they also have questions about her in terms of the emails and that sort of thing. What she has to do is lay out a positive agenda that makes some of the folks who are coming on board and thinking about voting for her, give them a reason to be a little more excited about that. And I think talking about how she wants to help college be more affordable, talking about the 10 million jobs she wants to create in the first 100 days, talking about that kind of work is going to help sway some folks who may still be wrestling, not with whether or not they vote for Hillary or Trump, but whether or not they vote for Hillary or a third party candidate or just don't vote at all.
Oh, Jamal, you're good. You got some of that policy in there. Again, the Democratic strategist. Ron Elving, weigh in.
This is a moment when, because of some of the remarkable things that Donald Trump has said over the last 10 days or so since the Democratic National Convention wrapped, people are paying attention in a way they almost never do in any August, even in a presidential year, and asking themselves, what's really going on here with these candidates? We're hearing so much negative about both of them. Is there anything positive that I can latch on to? Or do I need to go shopping for a Gary Johnson or a Jill Stein bumper sticker that I could put on my car? And right now, we're not seeing a lot of bump for Johnson and Stein, considering how high the unfavorable numbers are, well over 50%, mm-hmm. over 60%. In Donald Trump's case, given those unfavorables, you would think we'd be seeing record interest in the third party candidates. It doesn't seem to be happening. People just seem to be kind of stuck in neutral, a lot of folks, and they're looking to see one of these candidates capture their imagination. Tough to do when you've been in the public eye for 3 decades, mm-hmm. but sometimes people can breakthrough with an idea, with a thought, with some sort of a slogan, with some sort of formulation that might actually crystallize the way people feel about their own economic circumstances and their vote.
Don Gagne in Michigan, as we wait for Hillary Clinton to start speaking there about the economy, where are we right now in this presidential race? Because I've noticed that some of the states that were considered swing states are now moving into the blue Hillary Clinton category after all the things that have happened since the convention. And there are some states that weren't swing states that are now looking like they're swing states, places like Georgia and maybe even Arizona. How does it feel on the ground with the campaign? Are they projecting confidence that this is going to be easier than they thought in the Hillary Clinton campaign?
Not that it's going to be easy or perhaps easier than they thought. I think you would still put Michigan in that, leans Democratic category. Hillary Clinton did not win the primary here. And she does have a lot of work to do with working class voters in Michigan. But, she's looking to fare very well, not just in the cities and in the suburbs, but also with moderate Republicans in the suburbs around Detroit.
And, Don, I'm going to interrupt you to say that we think she's also looking at machinery. We can see pictures of her. I think she's making her way through this plant, the Futuramic Tool and Engineering plant in Warren, looking at some machinery there. But, you mentioned, and Jeremy asked, are they getting maybe a little, not complacent, but expecting something, a victory? And we understand that Ron Elving, one of the top aides in the campaign, sent out a letter saying, that's exactly what we cannot do. We can't get complacent.
Yes, and there is going to be fear that if Hillary Clinton does seem to build a lead or widen a lead in some states, some of the Democratic voters who have rallied to her in disappointment over Bernie Sanders losing or because they're so worried about Donald Trump might drift away either into not voting or maybe even to voting for Jill Stein or, you know, some other candidate, somebody they might write in because they're really not that fond of Hillary Clinton. So they need to keep up a high sense of mission, even if things seem to be going momentarily or temporarily at least their way.
Right. NPR business reporter Jim Zarroli, let me bring you back in because one of the things that's often said is it's the economy, stupid. It's the famous line from Bill Clinton's campaign aide, James Carville, back in the 90s, that's the really important issue for people. I'm looking and seeing that at this moment, as Hillary Clinton is preparing to speak, the Dow Jones Industrial is on track to set a new record high. Of course, a lot of people not feeling that right now in their own bank accounts or in their personal economy. But how's the economy doing right now?
Yeah, it's a strange time in the economy. I mean, as soon as you see one number that seems to say one thing, you see something else that says another thing. You know, we have a fairly low – we have an unemployment rate under 5%, but the growth rate most recently has been pretty weak. You know, there's a kind of a global slowdown, which is affecting the United States. But at the same time, we seem to be doing better than a lot of developed countries. I mean, Hillary Clinton, if she's elected, is going to face some economic challenges. One of them is just this, you know, really weak growth rate. Mm-hmm. We're not in a recession, but growth is kind of anemic and has been for a long time. It's just and how do you get out of that? It's something that a lot of countries are facing. Japan is facing it. Good part of Europe is facing it. So these are going to be things that you know, the next president is going to have to deal with.
And Douglas Holtz-Aiken, how would you describe the economy right now?
Well, I think Jim said it pretty well. It's not a strong economy, and it's actually a sort of a tale of two pieces of the economy. The household sector is actually doing reasonably well and has been supporting the rest, and the rest is not looking good at all. The business sector has seen rapidly shrinking profits. There's been a dearth of business investment. The international sector, because of the global weakness, is quite bad. And that can't persist. What you hope is that ultimately the household sector picks up the business sector and they move together and we grow faster. But there's a real risk that they both end up going south. And so the next president really needs to be focused on that issue and getting better growth. And it'll be interesting to see what Secretary Clinton says today about the business sector. It has been in the Democratic primary basically a whipping boy, but it has real economic problems right now, and the question is, will she provide some real economic policies for it?
Yeah. Oh, and Doug, also, would you comment on what we're expected to hear about infrastructure? You know, there was that big piece in the New York Times kind of saying that, you know, infrastructure might be the Democrats' way out, you know, promising it and rebuilding and revitalizing the economy that way. But we've been hearing that for a long time.
Yeah, it's like the magic genie in Democratic lands. You know, we're going to raise taxes, have regulations, and create 10,000 new entitlement programs. But hey, infrastructure, we'll grow just fine. And I think you have to take all that with a grain of salt. The Congress just passed in December a $300 billion transportation infrastructure program. And we didn't see the Congressional Budget Office or the Fed or anybody suddenly change their view of the outlook for the U.S. economy.
I have to bring in Jamal Simmons. Are you feeling challenged there?
I'm not feeling challenged in the sense that, broadly speaking, I do think you are seeing some improvements in the economy. I think the national unemployment rate right now is about 4.7%, but I was just looking at a number that had Macomb County's unemployment at about 5.6%. So the question is, for these working-class, blue-collar communities, are they going to be able to benefit from what's happening across the rest of the economy? And I think that's Hillary Clinton's challenge, is to make that really plain for voters about what she's going to do about it.
But I'm talking specifically about this idea that we keep hearing that infrastructure is the way, you know, as it was maybe however many years ago, that you create the jobs, you spend the money, and you revitalize the economy while also repairing the country. And it just doesn't seem to happen.
Well, I don't know that we've really done it in a way that has spent the amount of money necessary to do it. And that's what the president had an idea about, an infrastructure bank a few years ago. Mm-hmm. The Republicans seemed to be on board with that until the politics of the moment changed and people decided not to go along with it. We're going to have to make some serious adjustments in the economy about not only what do we repair, roads, bridges, and getting broadband infrastructure and all that work into the country, but then also are we going to make sure that jobs like that that go to people making $20, $30 an hour are the place we're going to spend the money? Or are we going to do tax cuts like what Donald Trump proposed with this 15% corporate tax rate, which he says go to small businesses, but it looks like 70% of it goes to people with big businesses, millionaires and billionaires. So I think that's the question we have. It's a comparative question about where we invest.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we are waiting for Hillary Clinton to start speaking about the economy in Michigan. She was expected to start at about 1:15 Eastern time, which was about 15 minutes ago. We've got a number of people from NPR here with us, as well as economist Douglas Holtz Aiken, former chief economist of the President's Council on Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. And you just heard Jamal Simmons there, Democratic strategist. I want to go back to NPR's Ron Elving. For people just tuning in, what are you expecting to hear from Secretary Clinton? What do you think? Is it going to be more about her plans, or is it going to be an attack on Trump?
It will probably be close to 50-50 would be our guess, and we don't have an advanced copy of her remarks. But if the indications that we have heard are accurate, then we expect her to talk a lot about what Donald Trump said here in Michigan on Monday. And she's going to poke a lot of holes. She's going to poke a lot of fun, in fact, at some of the things that he said, suggesting, for example, that repealing the estate tax is like repealing a tax on Donald Trump's friends and family, a sort of Donald Trump's friends and family plan, something of that nature. But she obviously has to put something on the table of her own. She has to talk about how her tax rates would compare. She has to talk about what she specifically would do for jobs. She is not nearly as good as Trump is at this kind of hortatory summation where she just throws out all of this rosy description of how great things are going to be. American steel, as Donald Trump kept saying at the end of his speech on Monday. American steel, American steel, American hands, and a new American this and a new American that. She's probably not going to be effective doing that sort of thing, but she is known for programmatic detail. She is known for practicality, and she may very well have some mechanisms in there that she can at least portray as being a much more realistic way of looking at our actual economic problems.
John, that was Ron Elving from NPR, but Don Gagne is there as well. And I just want to ask, maybe I'm desperately pulling at things here as we wait for Hillary Clinton to speak, but is that unusual not to have the speech beforehand?
No, mm-hmm. Especially on the campaign trail. Sometimes we get them, sometimes we don't. They've given us a little bit of background on the things she's going to talk about, which is kind of what we've all been discussing here, but not that unusual not to get an actual.
Darn it, I thought we were onto something there.
Robin, this is Jamal. Yeah. You know what is a little bit unusual, though, is we haven't seen from Donald Trump the kind of event like we're seeing from Hillary Clinton today, where she's on a factory floor, she's walking around with workers. That's the kind of thing where those pictures and that video shows up places on the web. Before she ever opens her mouth, you've got a sense about what she's talking about. I'm an old Clinton advance guy, so I recognize the tools that they're using. But you see Donald Trump in front of a blue drape with lots of flags, and it doesn't matter where he is. The pictures almost always look the same. He has to find a way to connect with people visually, I think.
Well,
also.
But he's got him in front of him. I mean, he's just got these huge rallies. So,
think that that's impressive.
Well, Don Gagne, one of the things that Trump did talk about the other day a lot is the thing that we think of when we think of the economy in Michigan, which is the auto industry. Mm-hmm. How's it doing right now?
It has improved, greatly. They've had several good years now. And I was just having a conversation before this started with Congressman Sander Levin, and he said when Hillary Clinton starts making that hard pitch to blue collar workers and specifically to auto workers and people who depend on the auto industry, that she will remind them. And he said, and he will remind them that it was under a Democrat, Barack Obama, that Chrysler and General Motors were saved from going under, in the first year of President Obama's time in office. So they will drive that home. And when Donald Trump talks about the auto industry, he does talk about jobs going to Mexico, and they're there has been an increase in jobs down there as well, and this area is still struggling. The jobs have not come back in any kind of a big way, even though the industry has more than stabilized. And again, sales have been doing pretty well, though I confess I'm not current on the current sales figures, not covering that industry anymore. But that is kind of the debate. And there is a certain level of anxiety here that is just baked in, right? No matter what the economy is doing. Nobody will just automatically think that all these jobs are going to be here forever like they once did in this industry and in this area.
NPR political correspondent Don Gagne. And I just want to bring Ron Elving back in for a second, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Whereas we wait for Hillary Clinton's economic speech, we are waiting for an economic speech. But I'm just thinking, CNN is now reporting that officials have said on background, and we're only seeing it on CNN, that the FBI discussed bringing a case against the Clinton Family Foundation. We're seeing these emails about the foundation maybe having too cozy a relationship with the State Department. We also know the FBI talked to Donald Trump about his comments about Second Amendment backers perhaps doing something about Hillary Clinton. Have you ever seen anything like this where we're, you know, trying to get, you know, economic policies and people are, you know, the FBI is perhaps talking to both candidates?
You know, it's not going to be a pretty campaign. It has been a pretty ugly one up to now. It's going to be increasingly so. Both candidates have high unfavorables. Both candidates know their easiest way to move the polls at any given time is to harp on those unfavorables for the opponent as opposed to making the positive statement or the constructive statement that we await here at the moment and that we keep saying we expect the candidates to make and the voters expect the candidates to make. But the cheap way to go, the quick way to go, is to go after whatever the vulnerability of the opposition is. And there's quite a bit in both cases, as we know. Probably not terribly surprising, although we don't have the details of this particular report, that there was discussion of possibly bringing a criminal case about some of the people who were going back and forth between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department. But would not be surprising that there would be people who wanted that story to be told, whatever the upshot of it was. Apparently, there was no decision to have some sort of an investigation. There was apparently no recommendation from the FBI to have such an investigation. But if there was even a conversation about it, then, well, in this environment, in this particular context, it's not surprising that people would want to put that on the news. No.
One of the things that you may be able to hear if your ears are really good is behind Don Gagne there in Michigan, you could hear somebody introducing, it sounds like, Don, the person who's introducing Hillary Clinton. Is that what's happening?
Yes. I confess I don't know his name. I believe it's one of the executives of Futuramic Tool here.
Okay. So
I think we said
just
Futuramic Tool enough, though. I think they'll be fine with that.
Well, and we are just minutes away from Hillary Clinton's big speech on the economy. But Ron Elving, do you think that if Hillary Clinton becomes the president of the United States, that she's going to go back to a lot of the people that advised her husband on the economy, some of them controversially?
Yes, and many of them, of course, are now quite well along in life, let us say. I mean, many of the people who were in President Clinton's cabinet back in the 1990s are probably not really candidates to rejoin a second Clinton cabinet now. But would she be pursuing the same philosophy, which a lot of folks have criticized as being too Wall Street-based, right? We all remember Robert Rubin. We remember the acolytes of Robert Rubin who took over largely in the years after. He was the leading economic voice in the first Clinton administration. We remember Larry Summers, who has still been around. And those names, I suspect, will probably not be.
And we got to stop you there right there, Ron, because Hillary Clinton has started in Michigan. Here she is.
Thank you so much. I have to tell you, I am thrilled to be here for a number of reasons. First, it's wonderful to be back in Michigan. And you can really feel the energy and dynamism that is driving this state's comeback. And in Detroit, we've got new businesses opening, neighborhoods like Midtown and Eastern Market are coming back. The auto industry just had its best year ever. Over in Ann Arbor, high-tech firms are thriving. The next generation of engineers are getting trained up in Houghton. And here at Futuramic, so well named, you are on the front lines of what I believe will be a true manufacturing renaissance in America. And I just was given a short but exciting tour by Mark Jurak and John Couch, who were telling me about how this company was started as, and for most of its early history, was an auto supply company. And then in 2000, as the market began to change and some of the auto companies began to realign, they were faced with a choice. We all face choices in life, don't we? And this company could have just said, hey, you know, our business is not going to be what it was. We got to just fold up. Let's, you know, just kind of quit. But that's not what happened here. And what happened here is what can happen across America. You are in now what is largely an aerospace company. And because of the workforce and the work ethic and the commitment of Futuramic, you are seeing the future unfold. So I got to see what's happening here to help build the SLS rocket that is going to go from Macomb to Mars. I saw the two halves of an F-35 nose cone waiting to be put together. I talked with some of the workers about the absolute perfection that is required to do this work. And what I believe with all my heart is that what's happening here can happen in so many places if we put our minds to it, if we support advanced manufacturing, if we are the kind of country that once again understands how important it is to build things. We are builders, and we need to get back to building. So we're making progress. None of us can be satisfied until the economic revitalization we're seeing in some parts of Michigan reaches every community, but it is inspiring to see this combination of old-fashioned hard work and cutting-edge innovation. And I know my opponent in this election was here in Michigan about a week ago, and it was like he was in a different place. When he visited Detroit on Monday, he talked only of failure, poverty, and crime. He is missing so much about what makes Michigan great. And the same is true when it comes to our country. He describes America as an embarrassment. He said, and I quote, "We're becoming a third world country." Look around you, my friends. Go visit with the workers building rockets. That doesn't happen in third world countries. Now, we have a lot of urgent and important work to do, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. Because all the people that I have met throughout this campaign really prove how wrong this negative, pessimistic view is. America's best days are still ahead of us if we make up our minds to actually go out and make that happen. Just consider our assets. We have the most dynamic, productive workforce in the world, bar none. We have the most innovative businesses, the top colleges, universities, community colleges, training programs in the world. and the best science and technology. We have enormous capacity for clean energy production. We are resilient, determined, hardworking. There is nothing America can't do if we do it together. And I know this because this is how I was raised. And I don't think Mr. Trump understands any of it. He hasn't offered any credible solutions for the very real economic challenges we face. Now, those challenges emerged long before the Great Recession, and they have persisted through our recovery. There is too much inequality, too little upward mobility. It is just too hard to get ahead today. But there are common sense things that your government could do that would give Americans more opportunities to succeed. Why don't we do it? Because powerful special interests and the tendency to put ideology ahead of political progress have led to gridlock in Congress. And how can you not be frustrated and even angry when you see nothing getting done? And a lot of people feel no one is on their side and no one has their back. And that is not how it's supposed to be in America. If I am fortunate enough to be your president, I will have your back every single day that I serve. And my mission in the White House will be to make our economy work for everyone, not just those at the top. This is personal for me. I am the product of the American middle class. I was born in Chicago. I was raised in a suburb. But my grandfather worked at the Scranton Lace Mill in Scranton, Pennsylvania for 50 years. And because he worked hard, my dad was able to go to college and eventually start his own small business and then send me out into the world to follow my own dreams. No matter how far those dreams have taken me, I have always remembered I am the daughter of a small business owner and the granddaughter of a factory worker and proud of both. So here's what I want. I want every American family to be able to tell the same story. If you work hard, you do your part, you should be able to give your children all the opportunities they deserve. That is the basic bargain of America. Now, whether we will be able to renew that bargain on even better terms for the 21st century depends in large measure on the outcome of this election. So here are four questions that I hope the American people will ask of both candidates, and that the answers should help make your choice in November crystal clear. First, which candidate has a real plan to create good-paying jobs? Second, who will restore fairness to our economy and ensure that those at the top pay their fair share of taxes? Third, who will really go to bat for working families? And fourth, who can bring people together to deliver the results that will make a difference in your lives? Now, I hope that after giving a fair hearing to both sides, you will join the millions of people across our country supporting this campaign, not just Democrats, but a growing number of Republicans and independents as well. Now, when it comes to creating jobs, I would argue it's not even close. Even conservative experts say Trump's agenda will pull our economy back into recession. And according to an independent analysis by a former economic advisor to Senator John McCain, if you add up all of Trump's ideas, from cutting taxes for the wealthy and corporations to starting a trade war with China, to deporting millions of hardworking immigrants, the result would be a loss of 3.4 million jobs. Now, by contrast, the same analysts found that with our plans, the economy would create more than 10 million new jobs. So let me tell you how we would do that. I believe every American willing to work hard should be able to find a job that provides dignity, pride, and decent pay that can support a family. So starting on day one, we will work with both parties to pass the biggest investment in new, good-paying jobs since World War II. We will put Americans to work, building and modernizing our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our railways, our ports, our airports. We are way overdue for this, my friends. We are living off the investments that were made by our parents' and grandparents' generations. We will also help cities like Detroit and Flint connect underserved neighborhoods to opportunity-expanding, affordable housing, and we will repair schools and failing water systems as well. You know, I happen to think we should be ambitious. While we're at it, let's connect every household in America to broadband by the year 2020. It's astonishing to me how many places in America, not way, way far away from cities, but in cities and near cities, that don't have access to broadband. And that disadvantages kids who are asked to do homework using the internet. 5 million of them live in homes without access to the internet. So you talk about an achievement gap, it starts right there. And let's build a cleaner, more resilient power grid with enough renewable energy to power every home in our country as well. Some country is going to be the clean energy superpower of the 21st century and create millions of jobs and businesses. It's probably going to be either China, Germany, or America. I want it to be us. We invent the technology, we should make it and use it and export it, which will help to grow our economy. And here's something that you don't always hear enough of from Democrats. A big part of our plan will be unleashing the power of the private sector to create more jobs at higher pay. And that means, for us, creating an infrastructure bank to get private funds off the sidelines and complement our private investments. $25 billion in government seed funding could unlock more than $250 billion and really get our country moving on our infrastructure plans. And we're going to invest $10 billion in what we're calling Make It in America partnerships to support American manufacturing and recommit to scientific research that can create entire new industries. When Mark and John were giving me the tour and I was talking to some of the workers along the way and asking them where some of the precision machinery came from that is being used here at Futuramic, what I hear all over the country, Germany, Japan, Italy, I want to bring that precision manufacturing back to the United States. There is no reason we can't begin to make those machines ourselves and supply the rest of the world instead of buying from somewhere else. Let's also expand incentives like the New Market Tax Credits that can bring businesses, government, and communities together to create good jobs in places that have been left out and left behind. From neglected neighborhoods in Detroit and Flint to logging country, coal country, Native American communities, from rural areas ravaged by addiction and lost jobs to industrial regions hollowed out when factories closed. As president, I will also make a major push to empower small businesses and entrepreneurs with new national initiatives to cut red tape at every level and expand access to credit, especially through community banks and credit unions. I will propose a new plan to dramatically simplify tax filing for small businesses. Right now, the smallest businesses, the kind that my dad had, because it was a really small business, spend 20 times more per employee to prepare their taxes compared to larger companies. It should be as easy as printing out a bank statement. Let's free entrepreneurs to do what they do best, innovate, grow, and hire. As Mark said, this company started because of a drive down a road and thinking about it, talking about it, then seeing one of the old Oldsmobile Futuramics and deciding, hey, not only do I have an idea, I've got a name. In America, if you can dream it, you should be able to build it. And we're going to get back to doing that. Now, Donald Trump has a different view. He's made a career out of stiffing small businesses from Atlantic City to Las Vegas. There are companies that were left hanging because he refused to pay their bills. A lot of those companies scraped together what they could to pay their employees, and many of them put their businesses at risk, and some of them ended up taking bankruptcy. It wasn't because Trump couldn't pay them, it was because he wouldn't pay them. And that's why I take it personally. My dad ran a printing plant. He had two really long tables. He printed fabric for draperies. He would lay out the fabric, and then he would take a silk screen, and he would go down the table. He'd put the silk screen down. He'd pour the paint in. He'd take the squeegee. He'd go across the screen. He'd lift it up. He'd go down, all the way to the end. Then he'd start on the other table. He worked hard. And then when he finished, he would load all that fabric up, put it in his car, and take it to the business that had ordered it, maybe a restaurant or a hotel or some office. He expected to be paid when he showed up. He did the work. He paid for the supplies and the labor that he often hired to help him on big jobs. He expected to be paid. I can't imagine what would have happened to my father and his business if he had gotten a contract from Trump and showing up and submitting his bill had been told, we're not going to pay. And if you don't like it, sue us. My father never could have sued a big organization like that. I just don't understand it. I've met all kinds of workers, painters, plumbers. I've met small businesses that provided pianos, installed glass or marble, all of whom were denied payment. And after going back time and again, being told, well, maybe we'll pay you 30 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar. That's not how we do business in America. So we've got to create more good jobs that are going to help more people. For example, our modern service economy is empowering consumers with more choices and greater flexibility, but we do have to empower the workers in our service sector too. The people taking care of our children and our parents, they deserve a good wage and good benefits and a secure retirement. And it's crucial that every American have access to the education and skills they need to get the jobs of the future. So we will fight to make college tuition free for the middle class.
This is special coverage from NPR News. We're listening live to Democratic nominee for President Hillary Clinton speaking in Warren, Michigan about the economy.
Liberate millions of people who already have student debt by making it easier to refinance and repay what you owe as a portion of your income so you don't have to pay more than you can afford. It is just not right that Donald Trump can ignore his debts, but students and families can't refinance their debt. And here's something else that I really want to emphasize. I don't think anybody in America is talking about this enough, and that is, a four-year degree should not be the only path to a good job in America. You should be able to learn a skill, practice a trade, make a good living doing it. So many Americans have the talent and the will to succeed. Whether they're kids right out of high school or older people displaced by automation and outsourcing. And for too long, big promises about the power of training and retraining haven't delivered like they should. It doesn't help anybody to be trained for a job that doesn't exist. So here's what we're going to do. We will support high-quality union training programs. We will propose new tax credits to encourage more companies to offer paid apprenticeships that let you earn while you learn. We will do more, including a national campaign to dignify skills training across the board. I think we've got to reverse what has become a kind of, commonplace view, which is everybody needs to go to college. Well, in fact, more than half of the jobs that are going to be available in 2020 do not require a college four-year degree. So for welders and machinists and tool and die makers and health technicians and coders and so many others, let's get the word out. There are really good jobs for people right now, and there will be more in the future if you get the skills in high school, at community college, in an apprenticeship, or other training program. And I want to acknowledge the great role that the community college here in Macomb County has played in working with companies like this one to make sure people do have the skills. Now, I imagine some of you might be thinking, well, that all sounds good, but what about trade? After all, Trump talks about it all the time. Well, let's start with this. It is true that too often past trade deals have been sold to the American people with rosy scenarios that did not pan out. Those promises now ring hollow in many communities across Michigan and our country that have seen factories close and jobs disappear. Too many companies lobbied for trade deals so they could sell products abroad, but then they instead moved abroad and sold back into the United States. It is also true that China and other countries have gamed the system for too long. Enforcement, particularly during the Bush administration, has been too lax. Investments at home that would make us more competitive have been completely blocked in Congress. And American workers and communities have paid the price. But the answer is not to rant and rave or cut ourselves off from the world. That would end up killing even more jobs. The answer is to finally make trade work for us, not against us. So my message to every worker in Michigan and across America is this. I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I oppose it now, I'll oppose it after the election, and I'll oppose it as president. As a senator from New York, I fought to defend New York's manufacturers and steelmakers from unfair Chinese trading practices, and I opposed the only multilateral trade deal that came before the Senate while I was there because it didn't meet my high bar. And as Secretary of State, I fought hard for American businesses to get a fair shot around the world and to stop underhanded trading practices like currency manipulation and the theft of intellectual property. So as president, I will stand up to China and anyone else who tries to take advantage of American workers and companies. And I'm going to ramp up enforcement by appointing, for the first time, a chief trade prosecutor. I will triple the number of enforcement officers, and when countries break the rules, we won't hesitate to impose targeted tariffs. Now, Mr. Trump may talk a big game on trade, but his approach is based on fear, not strength. Fear that we can't compete with the rest of the world, even when the rules are fair. Fear that our country has no choice but to hide behind walls. If Team USA was as fearful as Trump, Michael Phelps and Simone Biles would be cowering in the locker room, afraid to come out to compete. Instead, they're winning gold medals. America isn't afraid to compete. Right now, thousands of Michigan companies are exporting billions of dollars of products around the world. We want them to sell even more and create even more jobs here at home. But corporations should not abandon profitable operations here in the United States to move abroad just to give shareholders a quicker return. CEOs, a bigger bonus, and unions a weaker hand to play. Now, before he tweets, about how he's really the one who will put America first in trade, let's remember where Trump makes many of his own products, because it sure is not America. He's made Trump ties in China and Trump suits in Mexico instead of here in Michigan. He keeps saying it's not possible to make these things in America anymore, and that's just wrong. So we created a website, HillaryClinton.com/makeithere. On it, we list 100 places across the United States that are already producing similar goods. Now, one positive thing Trump could do to make America great again is actually make great things in America again. So, now let's look at the second question. Which candidate will fight for fairness? And this is an urgent need. We need to grow the economy and we need to make it fairer. The tide is not rising fast enough, and it is certainly not lifting all boats. Since the crash, too many of the gains have gone to the top 1%. The rules and incentives in our system reward corporations for putting short-term stock prices above long-term investments in their workers, equipment, and research. While corporate profits are at near record highs, paychecks for most people have barely budged. Incomes aren't growing fast enough to keep up with the costs of living, like prescription drugs and childcare. I believe that every employee from the CEO suite to the factory floor contributes to a business's success. So everybody should share in the rewards. especially those putting in long hours for little pay. So I'm proposing a new tax credit to encourage more companies to share profits with workers. And more broadly, we will fight for a more progressive, more patriotic tax code that puts American jobs first. Right now, when a corporation outsources jobs and production, it can write off the costs. We must stop that, and we must make them pay back any tax breaks they ever receive from any level of government in our country.
We are listening to Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton deliver her economic speech.
And for those that move their headquarters overseas to avoid paying their fair share of taxes, they're going to have to pay a new exit tax. So if they want to go, they're going to have to pay to go. And Wall Street corporations and the super rich should finally pay their fair share of taxes. That's why I support the so-called Buffett rule, because multimillionaires should not be able to pay a lower tax rate than their secretaries. We should also add a new tax on multimillionaires, crack down on tax gaming by corporations, and close the carried interest loophole, something I've advocated for years. Now, compare what Trump says. Now, there is a myth out there that he will stick it to the rich and powerful because somehow he's really on the side of the little guy. Don't believe it. Not when he pledges to rip up basic rules that hold corporations accountable, when he wants to scrap regulations that stop polluters from poisoning the air our children breathe and the water we drink, let insurance companies write their own rules again, Trump would roll back the tough rules that we have imposed on the financial industry. I'll do the opposite. I think we should strengthen those rules so Wall Street can never wreck Main Street again. Trump even wants to abolish the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a new agency that has already returned more than $11 billion to 25 million Americans who were taken advantage of by corporations. Why would you get rid of that? And then there is Trump's tax plan. He would give trillions in tax cuts to big corporations, millionaires, and Wall Street money managers. That would explode our national debt and eventually lead to massive cuts in priorities like education, health care, and environmental protection. In his speech on Monday, he called for a new tax loophole. Let's call it the Trump loophole. Because it would allow him to pay less than half the current tax rate on income from many of his companies. He'd pay a lower rate than millions of middle-class families. One nonpartisan expert at the Tax Policy Center described this plan as, and I quote, a really nice deal for Donald Trump. Of course, it's hard to say how nice, because he refuses to do what every other presidential candidate in decades has done and release his tax returns. But we do know that the 400 richest taxpayers in America would get an average tax cut of more than $15 million a year from the Trump loophole. And then there's the estate tax, which Trump wants to eliminate altogether. Now, if you believe that he's as wealthy as he says, that alone would save the Trump family $4 billion. It would do nothing for 99.8% of Americans. So they'd get a $4 billion tax cut, and 99.8% of Americans would get nothing. Just think of what we could do with those $4 billion. We could pay for more than 47,000 veterans to get a four-year college degree. We could provide a year's worth of health care to nearly 3 million kids. Or we could fund a year's worth of federal assistance to state and local law enforcement. I think there are a lot of better ways to spend the money. On Monday, I'm going to be in Scranton, Pennsylvania with Vice President Biden. And he has a saying, don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget, and I will tell you what you value. Well, Donald Trump wants to give trillions in tax breaks to people like himself. I want to invest it in veterans, our kids, our police officers, and so much more. And you can then draw your own conclusion about values. Now, it's true that both of us have proposed to cut taxes for middle-class families. He's making a big promise. But his advisors have said, his own advisors have said, he may not stand by them. Instead, the tax cuts he doubled down on in his speech in Detroit on Monday offer trillions to the richest Americans and corporations. And one of the differences between Donald Trump and me is I'm telling you what I will do. I'm laying out my plans, and I will stand by them and want you to hold me accountable for delivering results. You know, this all reminds me of that old saying, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And that brings us to the third question. Which candidate can you actually count on to go to bat for workers and working families? It is not enough to pay lip service to being on your side. We have to recognize how Americans actually live and work in the 21st century and then offer real solutions that make your lives easier. We know that women are now the sole or primary breadwinner in a growing number of families. We know more Americans are cobbling together part-time work or striking out on their own. So we have to make it easier to be good workers, good parents, and good caregivers all at the same time. That's why I've set out a bold vision to make quality, affordable childcare available to all Americans and limit the cost to 10% of family income. On Monday, Trump offered his first real ideas on this topic because previously he had dismissed concerns about childcare. He said it was, quote, not an expensive thing because you just need some blocks and some swings. Now he says he wants to exclude child care payments from taxation. His plan was panned from the left, the right, the center, because it transparently is designed for rich people like him. He would give wealthy families 30 or 40 cents on the dollar for their nannies and little or nothing for millions of hardworking families trying to afford childcare so that they can get to work and keep the job. I think instead we should expand the child tax credit to provide real relief to tens of millions of working families struggling with the costs of raising children, the same families that his plan ignores. And that's just a start. Because the more we do to help working families, the more our entire economy will benefit. For example, guaranteeing equal pay won't just increase paychecks for women, it will boost family budgets and get incomes rising across the board. And I don't understand why Trump's against that. Paid family leave won't only make life easier for moms and dads, it will also keep skilled, talented Americans in the workforce and grow our economy. That's why every other advanced country already has it. Again, he's against it. Raising the federal minimum wage won't just put more money in the pockets of low-income families. It also means they will spend more at the businesses in their neighborhoods. This is something that even the original automakers understood way back at the beginning of the 20th century when they decided to pay the unbelievable sum of $5 a day to auto workers. And when they were criticized by other businesses, how can you pay that much? They had the best answer. We want people to be able to buy our cars. This is economics 101. We need to get incomes and wages rising, and it will help the whole economy grow and be fairer. And protecting and expanding Social Security doesn't just help older Americans retire with dignity. It helps to ease burdens on families and communities. And I also believe the same thing about comprehensive immigration reform. We already have millions of people working in the economy and paying $12 billion a year to Social Security, even though they are undocumented. So by moving toward reform, we will unleash a lot of new income and growth, and we will level the playing field so that American workers can't be taken advantage of because undocumented workers can be exploited by employers, which is one of the reasons we have this disconnect. And finally, strengthening unions doesn't just serve members. It leads to better pay and benefits and working conditions for all employees. So, I've also said I will defend and improve the Affordable Care Act, and for me, that includes giving Americans in every state the choice of a public option health insurance plan that will help everybody afford coverage. It will strengthen competition and drive down costs. Now, these are all causes I've worked on for decades, and I believe they point to a fundamental truth about our economy. It can seem like a zero sum when you are competing for a job, a promotion, or a contract, if someone wins and someone loses, but that is not the full picture. If you step back, you'll see we're all in this together. If we can grow together, we can all rise together. Because you know what I like to say, we are stronger together, and that's why the fourth question is key, and it's this: who can bring people together to get any of this done? Right? Well, I believe I can, because I think I can provide serious, steady leadership that can find common ground and build on it based on hard but respectful bargaining with the other side. Leadership that rises above personal attacks and name-calling, not revels in it. I just don't think insults and bullying is how we're going to get things done. And I don't think that that's the appropriate approach for us. I know it's hard to imagine, but there was a time when Democrats and Republicans actually worked together. I know that's true. I did it as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State. It's how we created the Children's Health Insurance Program, which covers 8 million kids. It's how we rebuilt New York after 9/11 and how we passed a treaty reducing the threat from Russia's nuclear weapons. So I am convinced, based on my experience, that we can do this. And one of the reasons that I asked Senator Tim Kaine to be my running mate is that he also has a record of working across the aisle to get things done as a mayor, a governor, and a senator. So we're going to make full use of the White House's power to convene. We're going to get everyone at the table, not just Republicans and Democrats, but businesses and labor unions, academics, experts, but most importantly, Americans like all of you. I think there are a lot of great ideas out in America, and I want you to have a say in your government. And that means we've got to get unaccountable money out of politics, overturn Citizens United, and expand voting rights, not restrict them. I intend, starting even before the election, to bring together leaders from across our economy, from a lot of different places, to talk about jobs and competitiveness. And I hope Mark and John can join me, because we need the best ideas that are out there making a difference. We need to pull together. The bottom line is this: I'm running for president to build an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top. And based on what we know from the Trump campaign, he wants America to work for him and his friends at the expense of everyone else. He's offered no credible plans to address what working families are up against today, nothing on student loans or the cost of prescription drugs, nothing for farmers or struggling rural communities, nothing to build a new future with clean energy and advanced agriculture, nothing for communities of color in our cities to overcome the barriers of systemic racism, nothing to create new opportunities for young people, just a more extreme version of the failed theory of trickle-down economics with his own addition of outlandish Trumpian ideas that even Republicans reject. And as we heard him say at his convention, he may believe that he alone can fix our country, but clearly he doesn't know the people of Michigan. He doesn't see the businesses and the labor unions, the local governments, the clergy coming together every single day to make things better. So, yes, there is still a long road ahead, but Michigan is on the rise, and everyone is contributing. That's America at its best. So I hope you will stay active and engaged in working together to create jobs and to strengthen your own communities. And I hope you will work to get out the vote in November, because if we are able to win, then I want you all to work with me to build the kind of progress that America deserves to see. We're going to do this together. We are stronger together. Let's go out and build the future. Thank you all. God bless you.
You have been listening to Democratic nominee for President Hillary Clinton speaking in Warren, Michigan, outlining her major economic policies in live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. And we are joined right now by NPR Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, as well as Jim Zeroli, NPR business correspondent, and Jamal Simmons, who is a Democratic strategist. Ron, to you, give us a sense of what you heard there. Anything new? The one thing that I did notice that really was a line that we'll probably see again is on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I oppose it now. I'll oppose it after the election. And I'll oppose it as president, is what she said.
That's right, because a lot of people have been saying, including people in Hillary Clinton's own camp, that were she actually elected, she would probably come back around to supporting it as she had previously. She is trying to damp that down and trying to say at the very least that it would have to be renegotiated and recast before she signed it. However, she also did say in the course of this speech that she sees some single country leading the world in developing green energy, if you will, in the future. And she thinks it'll either be China or Germany or the United States, and she wants it to be us. And one of the things that the TPP was designed to do was to get the United States out there a little bit ahead of the Chinese with regard to relationships all around the Pacific Rim. So it gets complicated, and there was much balancing in this speech between what she sees as her practical goal and a desire to hit those points of, if you will, populist enthusiasm and emotional issues that she thinks will get her an edge in that area where Donald Trump has done so well.
Ron Elving there. How about Jim Zeroli stepping in, our business reporter? I noticed she did do specifics, which I know you always want details. There was a woman who was very vocal in the audience, and she said, uh-oh, when Hillary Clinton said, if companies want to leave, they're going to have to pay, leave the United States, they're going to have to pay an exit tax. If they want to go overseas, they're going to have to pay to go. Details like that. What else jumped out at you?
There was a lot of policy in it. I mean, I didn't hear anything that I thought was new. Mm-hmm. I mean, she talked about paid apprenticeship programs and an infrastructure bank, having a chief trade prosecutor. Those are all things she's talked about before. So I don't think there was anything new in that. I do agree that her opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership was more unequivocal than it has been in the past. I mean, she sort of fudged that for a while and sounded as though she might be willing to go along with it if it were changed. But she doesn't seem to be doing that anymore at all.
Well, and President Obama has still, as recently as right before he left on his vacation from Martha's Vineyard, been saying, well, I'm the president and I am in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So kind of incredible to see the Democratic nominee for president come out so strongly against something that the current Democratic president is in favor of. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, your thoughts on the speech?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a challenge because there are two different parts of the Democratic Party here that are in contest. The one part that says no trade deals almost ever. It's heavily union influenced. The other side is maybe a more pro-business, global economy-focused part of the party that says, you know what, we're in a global economy that's not going to change. The question is not, to my mind, the question is not whether or not we have trade or no trade. The question is, how do we prepare workers for a global workforce? And there are a whole bunch of ways to do that. Hillary Clinton touched on some of those. And the thing that's really hurting the workforce, we don't talk about enough at all, is technology and so many jobs being replaced by robots and software. And nobody ever touches that rail.
Now, do I understand we still have economist Douglas Holtz Aiken with us? Former chief economist of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. Now, both Jeremy and I wondered if perhaps she was quoting you when she spoke of an economist who had crunched some of Donald Trump's numbers for, I think, the John McCain campaign.
Was and that you? Was
that
she talking
you?
About you?
No, that's not me. I was the chief economist.
Right.
And this is Mark Zandi, who works at Moody's.
Yes. Mark Zandi, okay.
You know, this is a troubling thing that Democrats have done now for about 8 years. They know that he wasn't McCain's advisor. He never spoke to John. John never used any of his policies. None of that is true.
You're talking about Mark Zandi from Moody's, who is a Democrat.
He is a Democrat.
Yeah.
But they continually refer to him as John McCain's economic advisor, and that's just not true.
I see what you're saying. But okay, well, how did you feel, Douglas Holtz Aiken, about what you heard?
It's very familiar and very tired. A long list of small bore tax credits and government spending programs, as well as some bigger ones, but. There was one and only one mention of getting the private sector in the business of creating jobs and better wages, and that was through a government program called an infrastructure bank. And so the vision of the economy extends as far as the taxpayer, and that's it.
Well, you know, I was thinking, too, Jamal Simmons, step in here. I was thinking, too, that it felt in places like what we heard when Barack Obama laid out his economic plans even 8 years ago. But we haven't seen that kind of retraining of people for jobs or, the kinds of things that we heard then as well.
Well, you know, what's tough. What's tough?
Put that out there. Barack Obama ran to renegotiate NAFTA and did nothing of the sort. He had infrastructure and we had shovel-ready jobs and it didn't work and we had all of these kinds of initiatives. So how does she answer the question, you're just doing what has failed?
Well, let's bring in Jamal Simmons.
Well, one would say that the infrastructure that happened in the stimulus plan actually held the economy up and kept the floor from falling even lower. And now what we've seen are month after month, year after year of private sector job growth, and that's pretty hard to quarrel with. The question then gets back to where are we on the income growth for workers and the distribution of the benefits that are happening here. So that's the real question, I think, that we haven't answered. One thing that happened, the auto bailout, Don Gagne brought this up in our earlier segment, is he talked about auto employment and the number of jobs and cars that are being sold. We are seeing car growth come back, the sales of auto sales come back. But what happened in the deal was they cut the starting salary for auto workers from $28 an hour down to $14 an hour. That's what I'm talking about, that we've got to figure out how we fix. I think that may have gone up to about $15 an hour now, but we've got to figure out how we get those workers back in the game so that they can benefit from the increased productivity and sales.
Ron Elving, I want to bring you back in because another thing that Hillary Clinton talked about in her speech was she wants a public option for the Affordable Care Act. This was something that had been proposed, and even with 60 Democrats in the Senate, President Obama couldn't get that.
That's right. In 2009, when they were putting together the Affordable Care Act, which most people call Obamacare, this was part of the package, but it was seen very much as a bridge from Obamacare to a full dress national health care plan along the model of Canada or one of the European countries. And that was considered just a bridge too far. The Republicans were resisting every inch of the way, even though many of the bones of the plan, the DNA of the plan, went back to some Republican ideas back in the 1990s. But they saw this going in the direction of a national health care plan, and they were resisting and they're fighting very hard. There was a lot of pushback from the country. This was one of the main drivers of the Tea Party movement in 2009. And so what the final upshot was that they said, all right, well, we'll take the public option out. We won't let people essentially opt into a full government program, and we'll take that bridge away, and we'll just stay with Obamacare as private sector defined.
Ron Elling, I want to stay with you and look at another part of the speech through the political prism. How do you think Hillary Clinton did in setting herself out as the child of a man who owned a small business? He ran a printing plant. He laid out the fabric. When did you hear squeegees? You know, he used a squeegee to take his work out, whereas she tried to set up Donald Trump as someone who didn't pay, you know, small businesses like her dad's, you know, left them hanging. How did she do with that?
That's a narrative that obviously she and a lot of other Democrats have wondered at, because Donald Trump has been identified as somebody, and his businesses have been identified as somebody who did business in this fashion. And she does have a history that she can tell about being a factory worker's granddaughter and a small businessman's daughter, and her experience of the economy from that direction. It does not seem to have been that meaningful to a lot of the people that would seem to be the natural audience for it. People who look a lot like Hillary Clinton, people who are her age, her gender, and certainly her race, many of them, not as many as the men, but many of the women who are in Hillary Clinton's demographic category, have also been attracted to this message of America First and this message that somehow we're going to bring the jobs back, we're going to have all those coal mines open and pumping away like never before, and that, you know, American Steel will make a comeback and we'll do all these things as if it were 1955, 1960. She does not seem to have been able to hold back that tide, and she is trying very hard. I thought it was a relatively successful part of her speech when she was telling that personal story, but then to make the connection between that and the programs we're in today, that's a little tougher go.
Yeah. Jim Zaroli, NPR business correspondent, just a little time left here, but she did not mention the stock market. And while she was speaking, it is at a record, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up at 18,631. But yeah. Maybe in this era of income inequality, you just don't talk about that.
Yeah, it's that fine line she has to walk. There's a positive story to tell about how the economy has recovered under President Obama. The problem is if you sound too optimistic about it, that a lot of people come back and say, well, wait a minute, I'm not feeling that. So she tried to do both. I mean, parts of it were very positive speech. I mean, she talked about U.S. has the most dynamic, productive workforce in the world, resilient, determined, hardworking. There's nothing we can't do if we put our minds to it. She even invoked the names of some of the gold medal winners in the Olympics to describe the American spirit. But, you know, obviously a good part of the population is not buying that right now.
Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, we're going to give you the last word, but we're not to cheerlead. We want to ask you, I mean, the criticism of Donald Trump's speech was that he didn't give enough details. What's your criticism of Hillary Clinton's?
Well, I think that the questions about small business growth, there was some stuff in there about small business tax simplification and that kind of thing. But she really does need to focus more on how it is that we help entrepreneurs grow. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of Democrats who are looking for that. And that's the place where we'll see employment growth also among Black and Latino and women-owned populations.
Okay. That's Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, who's also been speaking with Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, and NPR business correspondent Jim Zaroli. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.
And this is special coverage from NPR News.